Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Chrysler.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 310 for November 13th of 2015. Excuse me, but is that a Panhard in the studio? Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 20 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Autoline After Hours. We're lucky. My co-host, Gary Vasilash, is with us. Just took the red eye in from California.
Yep. Good to be here. The weather was much nicer out there. I've got to tell you that right now because we're here in Detroit getting...
The weather in California was better than in Detroit? I'm shocked to hear this.
I'm just trying to come up with these revelations.
I thought that's why we lived here in Detroit.
For the weather?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So you were out driving the new Prius and the new RAV4 Toyotas.
That's correct.
Can you talk about them at all?
No, I can't.
Ah, dang it. Okay.
Because you'll be driving them, and if I were to talk about them, then I'd be letting the cat out of the bag, and they certainly don't want that to happen.
But usually they only, limit driving in impressions, and they let you talk about
the Prius is across the board
verboten to speak of.
Exactly.
Until the okay date, huh?
Yeah. So,
okay, we're not going to talk about Prius tonight.
We can talk about them another week.
Yeah. But what we do have to let everybody know is we got Ken Nelson joining us tonight, and we've got a really cool car in the studio here with us. Anybody who watches Autoline Daily will know that we use this as a sort of a trivia contest if anybody could guess what it is. So, Ken, first of all, welcome to Autoline After Hours.
Well, thank you, John.
And let's let everybody know what this car is. Tell them.
It's a 1966 Panhard 24BT. What those stand for, I don't know. It's the last in the series of Panhard automobiles.
Panhard, more like the French way of saying it, whereas I think most English speakers would call
right.
it Panhard.
Right. I can't even pronounce it the way the French do. It's very strange.
Yeah. We tried it earlier. We couldn't
right,
do it.
Right. But it's quite unique, and the interesting thing is, to me, I've always been interested in the history of automobiles. It is the very first production automobile company in the world, started by René Panhard and Émile Lavasseur in 1890. And that's pretty early. And in 1891, they had built 21 cars and 70 engines under license from Daimler. In fact, they started building Daimler engines under license in 1876.
What?
Yes. I've got an excellent history book here that came out a couple of years ago. It's really worth it. Done by an Englishman, David Baer. But it documents the history of these flat twin air-cooled cars. They're quite unique in their engineering. Panhard was actually a luxury car maker in the early days. Great big Art Deco automobiles like the Panhard Dynamique. I wish I had a picture of that.
Flamboyant car.
Yes. Ultra flamboyant.
Especially for the day.
Yes. I mean, Art Deco, ad infinitum, I think Jay Leno has one in his collection, along with three later model cars. And there's one in a collection in Florida.
Oh, here's one on...
There we go. Excellent. Okay. Yeah, that is really
over the top.
Yes. Absolutely. How could you get any wilder than that?
You know, it's interesting, you mentioning the history of this company and, when it started so early on and... I started looking into the history of what was going on at that time, and I think that we don't associate Paris with automobiles, yet at the time, Paris was actually the capital...
The hotbed.
...of automotive development. I mean...
And
there was on the order of 130 automobile companies at that time that were in
the Is that right? No, that I never knew.
And so there's all this development. And so Panard, the guy, he became a partner in a company that made machinery for manufacturing things out of wood. Hmm. And Gottlieb Daimler had actually worked at that company in the early 1860s for a couple of years. And then he left and moved on to England, and that's how they got the association to build the engines under license.
Well, that's why the history book mentions that René Panard was a carter. So he evidently built carts.
Mm-hmm.
And then progressed to the automobile.
Right.
I see. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, did Panard do the actual engineering himself? Was he an engineer?
Yes. There are a couple of engineers are listed in the history book. I forget their names. But there was a lot of engineering capability back then.
Well, you know, clearly, you know, just I'm sure anybody listening to the show is familiar with the Panhard rod.
Yes.
You know, in the rear suspension mm-hmm. of a car that have been around since I don't know when.
Forever.
So, you know, even though you may not know anything about the Panhard car company, you sure have heard of a Panhard rod.
Yes, and it's very frustrating. Whenever I go on eBay looking for parts, all I get is Panhard rods and clamps and brackets. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking for parts for the real car, so... Anyway.
Well, there was another interesting thing that he did back in 1891 was that they were the first to put the engine so that the crankshaft would be parallel
north-south.
And so, because if you think about it, back in the day, all of the engines were basically under the driver's seat.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, clearly, this guy foresaw the need for having larger engines. And so the architecture of vehicles as we now know them with hoods goes to him, I think.
Yes, they do get the credit for the basic layout of the modern automobile.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
That I didn't know.
Yeah, that's in the book too. Yeah, so it's documented.
Mm-hmm. So let's come back to the BT.
Okay.
How did you end up with this car? Why did you even want this car in the first place? Because this is... I mean, is this one of a kind in the country, or...?
There may be six in the country, as far as I know. There's, a friend up in Midland, Michigan, has one. He has his own European car repair shop. Dale Martin's his name. I've got a friend over in New York, Carter Willie, who has a very nice one. And I think there's another one on the West Coast, and I think there might even be one over in Western Michigan. I've talked with a fellow over there, but I haven't really gotten to take a look at it. So maybe six in the country.
Okay.
Something like
Pretty
that.
Pretty rare car.
Right.
And so how'd you come across this thing, and what made you want to own this?
Well, I've sort of been a Francophile for 52 years, starting with DS-19s in 1962. And their engineering and thought processes are so bizarre compared to what we're used to that I just sort of got hooked on figuring out, why did they do this? And hey, that's neat. And gee whiz, why don't we do that? Things like that. And the Panhard, being kind of a stepchild of Citroën, who bought them in 64 and shut them down permanently in 67, they thought alike, but Citroën was more interested in selling their own cars, and Panhard was nearly always bankrupt, very close to it.
And probably bankrupt because they were over-engineering their cars?
Well, I don't think their cost accountants were that good, because when they moved to what I call their Jelly Bean series about 1954, called a Dina, a Z1 up to 59.
The Dina, pretty famous car.
Right. In fact, wasn't there a Super Bowl ad a while ago with a miniature Napoleon, a shrunken Napoleon, driving a Panhard around?
Is that right?
During a Super Bowl ad, yeah. It was their mainstream car, you might say, after the war. They started in 1946 building a two-cylinder small car, economy car, and in 1954 they went to the Jelly Bean. And that continued through until this model, which came out in 1964, and they carried on along with that. The interesting thing to me about this car is its engine. It's a flat twin, air-cooled, 850cc, in this car putting out 60 horsepower. That's
a lot of horsepower for that engine.
Right. The absolutely fascinating thing to me about the engine is it has an all roller bearing crankshaft, and the bearing on the connecting rods was designed by none other than Leonardo.
Da Vinci.
Da Vinci.
Okay, so you got to tell that story.
I personally saw his sketch in the archives of his last home in the Loire Valley of France in 2005, and I darn near fell over. Two small separator rollers separate the load-bearing larger ones, and they're rolling backwards, so there's no sliding friction between the bearings, the rollers. It's all rolling friction. And when you read the explanation for why this works so well in this engine, when somebody could finally make it, is that roller bearings tended to skew at very high RPMs and jam and wear the rollers out, according to all the stuff in the history book. With this technology and design, they were able to achieve an 8,000 RPM rev line and durability, which they could never do before. This engine came out designed basically to go to 7,000 RPM for the life of the car.
And 7,000 RPM, and this is, when was this engine designed, more or less?
46. 46.
And what gave them the idea to go back to a Leonardo da Vinci design for bearing braces?
I cannot connect that. But obviously he lived in France, so probably somebody studying Leonardo's history over the years, it kind of popped to the surface.
So is there something about the material, or is it just purely the geometry of the design that...
It's a geometry and the layout. There are two races on the single journal, staggered. So a small one is opposite a large one, and evidently all these little details eliminate skewing, which can jam a bearing completely and ruin it. And they evidently spent a lot of time designing this thing and testing. But not only does it have roller bearings all over, it's got roller lifters, aluminum push rods, and it's a Hemi head with no head gasket, and it has hydraulically adjusted valves, not via the lifters, but via the rocker arm. Because it's running on 3 PSI oil pressure, because you cannot get oil directly to the bearings. The camshaft is a squirt gun, squirting into catch rings on the end of the flywheel and centrifuging it into the conrods. It was designed for super efficiency with everything they could throw at it. In fact, they couldn't get coil springs to last at that RPM. They had to switch to torsion bars for reduced reciprocating mass.
Torsion bars for the valves.
For the valves. And not only did they start with torsion bars, each valve had its own torsion bar, they then went coaxial, one inside the other, and ended up with an almost desmodromic valve arrangement in that when the push rod pushes one valve open, that spring transfers the load to the other valve and pulls it tighter shut. So they've got a lot of very clever features on this thing, and which is why it got such efficiency and always won its class at Le Mans in the late 50s when they were raced in the Deutsche Bene HBR5 coupes.
So what is the extent to which this technology that they developed has been used subsequently by other manufacturers, or is it all gone?
I have never seen any other application of it, and I've heard of other different roller designs. I've known people who built special crankshafts to race at Bonneville with these engines using split roller bearings, caged. I'd love to know if anybody else uses this design.
It sounds expensive.
I believe it is.
It sounds like there's a lot of machining and assembly involved in this.
There is, but then the French were always into that sort of thing.
So give us some specs. You said 800 cc. You said, what, 60 horsepower?
850 cc, and with a fairly wild cam in this engine, 60 horsepower. The original sedan started out with maybe 750 cc's and moved up to 850. So they started maybe 20, 30 horsepower in the late 40s, went up to 40 horsepower, about 54, and then 50 in slightly later engines, and 60 being the most with this one. But always the same design, basically.
So, but the car moves, right? It doesn't feel like some little pokey 850cc car.
No, it's noisy as the Dickens, but it runs. And being a flat twin, it's very smooth. And I've had it up to 87 miles an hour on 94. And I'd love to take it out to 100, but I'm worried about blowing something up because I've never really gotten into the engine.
These very complicated Da Vinci parts are probably
somewhat
on the rare side.
Yes, I am trying to learn how to rebuild the crankshafts myself,
mm-hmm.
because otherwise it's pretty expensive.
Sure.
And you got to go back to France. Anyway.
So this car, I mean, was it a family car? I mean, it's a coupe or coupe, as I'm sure that they say in France. But,
well, all the other cars were four doors.
Uh-huh.
It was a family car. It was an economy car because they looked at the situation in France after the war and said, well, we've got no petroleum, we don't have any industry, it's been bombed flat, and we need transportation. So it was another version of, you might call it the 2CV Citroën, only it was a hot rod by comparison.
Well, anything's a hot rod compared to a 2CV.
Well, for example, in 54, 55, when they first came out with the Dina series, the bodies were entirely aluminum. And according to this book by David Baer, the entire body shell weighed 220 pounds.
Which is nothing.
Nothing. All the panels, the body in white, 220 pounds. But they had to quickly switch to steel because it was costing them triple the cost of a sheet metal, a steel body, and they were about to go bankrupt in the first time.
Hmm.
So they switched piecemeal to steel. And by 58, I think they were all steel. But you could still do 90 miles an hour on 40 horsepower and get 40 miles per gallon.
Hmm. What kind of fuel economy do you get in this? Do you track it?
I'm assuming it's less than 40, what with the 60 horsepower, but I haven't really tracked it. But the others, I know, would get you 40 miles per gallon.
This is also quite an aerodynamic car. And especially for the day, it's very aerodynamic.
Yes.
But what strikes me even more is it's a very clean-looking design.
Mm.
I mean, it looks much more modern than you said 66, right?
Yes.
Than a car from 66.
Right.
But it sort of strikes me that it has almost a Citroen-like front end and then an early BMW rear end.
Yes.
Well, and a lot of people think it's Corvair.
And there is that, too. But that's probably the short rear deck and sort of the high... mm-hmm. greenhouse.
Well, when you think of cars of that era, late 50s, early 60s, you think the BMWs, NSUs.
Right.
They were all kind of, I think of them as casseroles,
mm-hmm.
sort of a lid on top of a pot.
Right.
And very squared off.
Mm-hmm.
But the French were always, at least with Citroën and Panhard, quite interested in aerodynamics for efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
They always pushed that.
But it's interesting if you look at the attention to detail, the way the sheet metal is formed above the front wheels, that little line there that you would think that someone would just stamp it flat, but they just said, no, let's just add this touch here.
Right, a little class.
Just a touch.
Yeah.
You mentioned that book a couple of times. One of our viewers, Jonathan, wants to know, do you know the name of the book?
Yes, it's called... I think it's the 1946 to 1967, The History of the Flat Twins by David Baer, B-E-A-R-E. It's only been out about 2 years. He actually has a foreword by the last of the Panhard family when he was 100 years old.
Wow.
Writing in the foreword on it. And another one by a fellow who's head of one of the major museums in Europe, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredibly well-written book, and the detail is just astonishing.
Is it in English?
It is in English,
okay,
yes.
Just...
yes. And it's published by, get this, Stinkwheel Press.
Which, not the choice that I would make if I were going to have an automotive publishing company. But
there's a history lesson there. That's taken after a powered rear wheel that you could stick on a regular bicycle, and it was a two-stroke. So it was noisy as heck, and it stank.
Is there anything on the interior of the car that you find to be somewhat ahead of its time?
The visibility. The ergonomics on these cars, I credit all of them. I've learned a lot about Peugeots recently from my son, who's gotten into those. They take supreme care of their derrieres. The French know how to be comfortable, hence the DS with its hydropneumatic suspension and superb seats. But the convenience, the rear seat flips down. You can put skis through the car. The front seats fold all the way down flat. You could sleep in it if you're short. It's got a lot of features I like. Oh, the entire front end lifts up. You undo a few bolts, and the entire front end comes right up at the firewall for access.
There's a picture of it there.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
There it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was just a couple of days ago. The earlier cars, the front end was entirely one piece. The hood and fenders were one, integral. And they came up as, you know, like a Bug-Eye Sprite.
So there's no hood that opens?
There is on this one.
Oh,
yes.
So it lifts, but there's also a hood.
Oh, yes. You can take the hood off without any tools. You get it up to vertical, and it unlocks from a crossbar.
Okay.
And then you can undo a few bolts, and the entire front end can be lifted up and propped up for access, just like that picture. And the earlier cars, of course, when the aluminum cars were out, and I have a couple of those, you know, one hand, the entire front end of the car lifts up.
And wait a minute. You got a couple of these BTs?
No.
Or the 24?
The earlier ones.
Oh.
The Dinas.
What do you have?
Way too many of them. I hate to see them become, let's say, Asian vices. Okay? So I guess I like to save them. I hate to see them.
What else do you save besides Citroëns, obviously?
Yeah,
and
Connards. Well, I've saved a Goliath. I've saved a couple of NSUs. I've got a Wankel Spider that I need to sell, the first rotaries.
Wow.
A Matra Benet de Jet 5S, which was the first ever mid-engine sports car ever built. Hmm. Well, the oddball stuff. I like the oddball stuff.
Why so? What attracts you to that?
The engineering, the thinking, the fact that, hey, there are other ways to do things. My basic career job was coming up with ideas for the auto companies and how to use high-strength plastics to lightweight the cars, reduce costs, improve fuel economy. And it all comes out from my father buying a Citroën in 1962. And we had to teach ourselves, and it was just astounding, the differences.
Between them, Citroëns, and American cars of that era.
Absolutely.
Night and day.
Absolutely.
Nothing common.
You're right.
Maybe tires.
It taught me, working on that car taught me more physics than my undergraduate degree classes. Serious, practical physics. Oh, the body panels all unbolt on this car, just like a Citroën. And Fiero, of course, borrowed that for their production methods. Everything unbolts.
So the sheet metal is not welded.
Right. It is
in a unibody. It's bolted to a frame.
It's all the roof on this one may be welded on, but not Citroën. Everything. Mm-hmm. You've got a drivable chassis.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're mentioning the engine specs, and our viewers, Maverick, wants to know, is that horsepower to the current SAE standard, or is...
Good question. I cannot answer that.
Okay.
All I know is that when I was driving my 59 Dina Z16, which I bought from Chrysler's China car program, after working with Ken Mack and other people over there under Francois Castaing.
The CCV program?
Yeah. Yeah, I have the Panhard that came into that collection via Bob Lutz. Hmm. And I was clocked leaving the Orphan Car Show some years ago after I got it at 85 miles an hour on 23, and I wasn't even flat out.
So tell us a little bit about that China car program, and why would Chrysler have brought in these cars like you're talking about?
Good question. It was the brainchild of Francois Castaing, who came over from AMC and, of course, is French, and grew up keeping his feet warm in a mummy bag, driving a Duchevaux to school in France. And he had the concept of, you could call it a toy car, model car kit, two clamshells made out of injection-molded plastic with molded in color to save $500 million versus a paint plant. If you could eliminate paint, you
You save a lot of money. Yeah.
Yeah. Not to mention quality control and everything else. Mm. So the idea was a clamshell car for China before China has taken over the world. And because they'd done some research and found that the typical mode of transportation in the boonies of China was a one-lung garden tractor pulling a four-wheeled cart with the family and all the produce on it, which sold for about $1,200. And if I recall right, they were talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of $3,000.
For this car?
Yes, huh. With a two-cylinder engine. And hence, the Duchevaux was the first thing they brought into the program.
To study what Citroën had done back in the late 40s.
Yes, they brought in a 57 somebody had restored on the East Coast, immediately broke the transaxle. They wanted to make custom-make gears. I got them a decent replacement for $50. And they put it back on the road, not at the proving grounds. And then they brought in a Briggs & Stratton engine with a Subaru transmission, and they built their own mock-up, which looked a heck of a lot like a Duchevaux.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
The fiberglass.
Do you remember that car, Gary?
Yeah, and they actually, it was interesting. So it was a thermoplastic two pieces.
Husky. Right.
And
Husky molded them.
Husky Molding was doing all the molding. I remember going to the plant.
Yes, I was in that plant.
Yeah, and then the interior was even injection molded, as I recall, that they just wanted to make it as dead simple. Because I think it was 6 or 8 pieces overall that you would need to assemble.
I think you're right.
To make this car. Right. And a lot of the work was done in Western Michigan at Cascade Engineering.
Yes.
Because they were injection molding large trash receptacles, the giant dumpsters, and yes. so they had presses with sufficient platen size to be able to do that, and they were doing some right. early work
not
there.
Not too far from here. So when they finally got that one side mold. I worked with them the first year of the program as DuPont's consultant on the project because I'd also worked on the Chrysler LH plastic fender series. And I looked at this and said to myself, wait a minute. We don't have a structural plastic that could take a collision like sheet metal can. And I suggested, why not buy the Duchevaux plant, which was closed down in 1990, and use tubular steel that any bicycle guy could fix, and use a DuPont snap-on plastic panel that we then used for bumper covers. And in an accident, you'd pop the panels off, you'd straighten out the tubing and put the panels back on.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody had an inexpensive structural plastic that could take the requirements, in my mind. And we were in competition with other plastics companies, but the price they needed was just unobtainium. But I was there when they brought in the Duchevaux at the beginning of the program, and then later on the Pinard showed up that Bob had found, as I understand it, at some engineering shop on the East Coast. And being European, he knew the cars and the potential there and brought that car in. So that's basically the history of the program.
That's very interesting. You know, I love what Lutz and Castaing were doing of going back to older cars for inspiration.
Yes.
And I want to say, I might have this wrong. It might have been Jack Telnak, who was the head of Ford Design years ago. And I want to say he took his design group through the Henry Ford Museum, which, as you all know, has a whole lot more than just Ford cars in it. It's got a whole lineup of things. But again, for that very same thing, let's go back and look at what some of the best minds in the history of this industry have done.
Sure.
And how do we learn from that? How do we modernize it?
Well, that's what's been frustrating to me because I worked with a lot of newly minted engineers, and they'd come up with an idea, and I'd say, right, that's been around a while, guys. And when you look at it, in 1904, Porsche had a four-wheel drive electric automobile.
Yeah. Hybrid.
Yes.
The loaner Porsches, right?
Yeah.
In fact, I want to say like the first 4 or 5 cars that Porsche designed were hybrids, pure electric and or hybrid.
Yes. And there was the beauty of the beginning of the era was that people could, whatever they could think of, they could build and tried to, and they tried so many different things. And we've forgotten a lot of that history. And we keep reinventing the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we do.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, look, We got to pay some bills here, as they oftenly say. We've got to take a quick commercial break here, and let's give a good shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. And so we're back.
Okay, so at this point of the show, it's always a good idea to show a number, because I know you depend on me having these numbers.
Dr. Data better have his number, you bet.
All right, so Carmen, can you bring the number up, please? Okay, so this is a very innocuous-looking number, 1201.
That's when the bolts for this Panhard were designed for the wheel lugs, right?
Yeah, it was done by, no, it had nothing to do with that, but this has to do with the subject that you have talked about on the show several times, and it relates to, and I quote, exemption to prohibition on circumvention of copyright protection systems for access control technologies.
Remember, okay, translate, please.
So remember when we were talking about people hacking cars and about how the automakers, many of them, were against people having the rights by which they would be able to go in
and deal with it.
And so the Association of Equipment Manufacturers, Association of Global Automakers, Auto Alliance, Eaton, GM, John Deere, Motor Manufacturers Association, they were all saying, keep people out of our cars. This is our software. It turns out that the U.S. Copyright Office, which is part of the Library of Congress, which I never realized, they decided that was not going to fly, that they made an exemption to that. So, as it says, computer programs that are contained in and control the function of a motorized land vehicle, such as personal automobile, blah, 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 people actually will have the right to go in. And so the exemption is for the Section 21201. And, you know, which is, but it's interesting that they made the ruling, but there's going to be a year before it goes into effect. So, I find it sort of fascinating that the whole Volkswagen thing was found in large part because researchers were able to go into the control units and find the software. Had this stood, they would have not been able to do that because it would be prohibited.
Wow. Very interesting.
So, anyway.
This was the patent office, did you say?
Yeah. So a couple weeks ago, they decided that they would, you know, allow people to go in and look at that code. So it is not General Motors or Eaton's or you know, somebody specific.
So automakers cannot protect their source code is essentially what it's saying, isn't it?
No, it's saying that if you have a car, the same way that if you needed to fix something, mm-hmm. you know, and you wanted to change spark plugs and it came with certain set of spark plugs and you wanted to put a different set of spark plugs in there, you'd have the right to do that. The same way, mm-hmm. because you bought the car, you'd have the right to go in and make these other modifications.
Very interesting. So, I missed that. Thank you for bringing that number in. Yeah. So what else has happened this week? Hey, what do you think of Hyundai starting its own new luxury brand?
I think that, A, it's perhaps overdue for them to do that because they've had these...
They've wanted to do it for years.
They came out with the Genesis. They brought in the Equus to the market, so... Two high-end models there. I think what's interesting about this, though, is that, you know, the guys at Hyundai really are working it hard. And I have this feeling that if you're a guy at Audi or BMW or Lexus or Cadillac or Lincoln, man, you've got to watch it because these guys are just going to come hard. And just throw in boatloads.
But as you know, I mean, the luxury segment's a little bit different, and just showing up with a great car often is not enough. I say often because Lexus did it. But Infiniti's never really caught on. Acura's never really caught on. Cadillac and Lincoln are struggling to try to get back to where they once were. Mm-hmm. So it's not just having a beautiful car, good technology and all that. Heritage counts. Can they pull this off?
Well, see, but the question, this gets back to, you know, the sort of the modern era that we live in now when we see this, you know, Panhard car with pedigree up the wazoo. But if you think about consumer products that are out there now, that, okay, what is it aspirational in terms of technology. It's Apple. How old are they? Yeah. How many people buy Samsung phones because they think they're really cool and really capable? So if you have this generation that basically is coming into this and saying, I don't care about how old that company is. I care about what that company is going to bring to me in terms of technology and capability and style and so on. And, you know, it's just not about heritage.
I think it's different when you get into luxury goods.
I don't know.
So let's see here. We've got another question come in or not. Oh, here's a good one. Maverick wanted to know, do you believe the VW emissions issue is due to a lack of engine redesign to U.S. regulations, similar to the lack of redesign of the gas engines to operate on regular fuel?
Well, did you happen to see Bob Lutz's, the aforementioned Bob Lutz's, he had a piece in Road and Track about how it was Dr. Piek's
fault. This is all Piek's fault, is what he
because did. He was demanding that they have a diesel and demanding that they have the diesel that works.
Right.
And it sort of strikes me that, I mean, if you look at Michael Horn's testimony before Congress, and he was basically saying that it was a couple of engineers, which I know sounds crazy and I know sounds nuts, but I mean, I'm not wholly unconvinced that it isn't a situation whereby, you know, because as Bob points out in that piece, I mean, these guys are worried about losing their jobs. And therefore, it's like, let's just get this thing to work now so we'll get this guy off of our back. And you know, otherwise he's going to tell us to clear out our desks. So I think it was not a lack of engineering, not a lack of unawareness of regulation, not a lack of capability. I think it was a concern over covering one's job.
Yeah, I think it's going to go all the way to winter corn. There's an interesting piece in today's New York Times saying that in Europe, some of these defeat devices may not be illegal. They'll be against the spirit of the law, but they may not be illegal. That apparently there was some loophole in the European regulations that said you could be allowed to run into a performance mode for an ambiguous amount of time. Mm-hmm. And that, in point of fact, you know, the whole VW cheating thing is definitely illegal in the U.S. May not be illegal, even though it violates the spirit of the law. And, you know, when Winterkorn resigned or first admitted the whole thing, he said, I never did anything illegal that I'm aware of. And I found that a really curious choice of words. And so could it be that they said, hey, Dr. Winterkorn, look at this. You know, we've got this defeat device, but if you look at this loophole, hey, we think it's legal. He goes, bless you, boys. Go ahead and run with it. Mm-hmm. And now he's going, hey, I didn't think I did anything illegal that I'm aware of. And I wonder if this whole VW thing, in Europe at least, is going to come down to these very fine legal nuances.
Okay, so let's think about it. Let's say that's true, okay? So here, 500,000 cars are found to be in violation of the law. VW has to deal with these things, and so they'll give out gift cards, and people will be happy, right? Yeah, sure.
Yeah, right.
Okay, but so now there's, what, 11.5 million in Europe?
Right.
The number? So do you really think that if you're in Europe that you would be happy to discover that even though this violates a law in another Western country, the United States, that just because you live in Germany or France or England or wherever else, that it's going to be okay because there was a loophole? I think that would cause people to light torches and head right into Wolfsburg and chase them out, just like, you know, Frankenstein's castle.
Yeah, but I think what I'm getting at is I don't believe it was just a handful of rogue software engineers. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, now it's coming out that, oop, maybe we overstated CO2 emissions, and, oh, yeah, by the way, there is a gasoline engine involved, and I'm waiting for the next shoe to drop. Mm-hmm. I think there's more to come. And I think with so many different engine models, different kinds of regulated emissions being violated here, And it going on for so many years
right.
tells me this isn't just a few handful yeah. or a handful of rogue. I think it's going to go all the way right up to Errol Winterkorn's desk.
So what is this going to do to the company's prospects going forward if they have to pay fines, they have to retrofit engines, they have to deal with, I don't know, incarcerated executive? I mean,
yeah, no, the list goes on and on.
Right, but I mean, but what are the fortunes of this company going to be?
That's a great question. And, you know, everyone's speculating about it. But I do believe it is entirely possible they're going to have to sell off businesses. You know, we've talked about this on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you keeping Bugatti? You don't make any money at it. Now you got to, you know, pour all this cash into developing a new model. Well, that money's already been spent. Okay. Why do you have Lamborghini? Does it really make a whole lot of sense to have Bentley? How profitable is it? I guess I'm going to have to go look that up. They've got these truck operations, Scania and MAN. Maybe those are going to have to be sold, and there will be willing buyers for the truck operations, that's for sure.
Ducati?
Ducati's another one that's sort of, you know, I don't know. It seems to me they bought it for bragging rights more mm-hmm. than that it fits into any portfolio. So I think they'll not get rid of Porsche. They'll not get rid of Audi. Skoda they'll keep for sure. Seat's probably safe is my guess. But if this bill, this litigation and repair and recall and regulatory fines and maybe even Department of Justice fines add up to, I mean, people are talking about 35 billion euros. There's even some estimates that go much higher than that. I mean, that's a mega financial hit. And remember, the company is now worth one-third less.
Right.
Than it was, you know, in March of this year.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I got to look this up. I think its market cap is now about the same as GM or Ford, you know, and it used to be so much more than that. So long story short is, I think it's entirely possible we'll see a smaller VW AG come out of this.
So how do you think consumers are going to feel about the $500 Visa gift card that you can spend on anything you want and a $500 gift card that you can spend at your local Volkswagen dealer?
Yeah, well, the local Volkswagen one, people are going to, they're not going to think much of that. The $500, spend it any way you want. I think there'll be a lot of VW diesel owners that go, cool, okay, that's great. I'm never going to buy one of their cars again, but I appreciate the $500. But I think that the people who bought it for environmental reasons, who said, look, I got to do my part for the planet, and wow, here's a diesel that is a whale of a lot of fun to drive. And it gets 44, 45, maybe even up to 50 miles per gallon on the highway. Man, I'm doing my part. And now you're trying to buy me off with some $500? I don't think they're going to go for this.
You know, what sort of strikes me is if you think back, you know, we were basically talking about earlier vehicles before. But you remember when Saturn, they had a problem early on, and they made it like a picnic at the dealerships. They were cooking hot dogs and, you know, bring your car in, we'll give you a balloon and a hot dog. And people were ecstatic about that because they basically sort of orchestrated this of saying, okay, we're wrong, mea culpa, but you know what? We're going to make it right and we're going to make you feel good. I just have a feeling that if you're a VW owner and you get this check, you know, this Visa gift card in the mail, you're going to, what the hell?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not addressing this thing you're talking about of I'm an environmental person or I'm somebody who just really wanted to be thrifty in the long run, so I'm buying a diesel rather than buying the gasoline engine, and now they're sending me $500? What is this?
And besides, these days, what do you get in the mail? Junk.
Yeah.
You get junk and bills. It's, to me, very impersonal.
Mm.
Yeah, look, they're groping their way through this. You know, they're trying to do anything right now to get people's minds off it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't. Look, they're trying something. I give them credit for that. Do I think this is going to work to retain customers? No, I do not.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, look, we got to take another quick break right now. We're going to give a shout out to our friends at Chrysler.
There is no royal blood in this country. Nothing is reserved for anyone. It's all just out there, waiting for someone to reach out and take it. And the ones who do, these are the kings and queens of America.
So, Gary, one of the things that caught your eye this week, Toyota spending a lot of money on robotics.
Yeah, $1 billion over 5 years, and they're going to be establishing new R&D facilities in Palo Alto, California, and then they're going to be setting up another one in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And the announcement was made in Tokyo. So this is Toyota Corporate is putting, you know, as I say, $1 billion over a 5-year period in establishing this, and they've already announced that this is in addition to $50 million that they're investing in MIT and Stanford for doing artificial intelligence research, and it's very interesting to me that, you know, part of what they're doing, they're taking this guy named Gilbert Pratt and putting him in charge of this operation, and he says our initial goals are to, one, improve safety by continuously decreasing the likelihood that a car will be involved in an accident, autonomous.
Yeah.
Make driving accessible to everyone regardless of ability.
That's autonomous.
Three, apply Toyota technology used for outdoor mobility to indoor environments, particularly for the support of seniors. Well, there's that aging Japanese population,
right,
very keenly interested in having some devices to,
right,
to help them out. And I thought this is interesting. We also plan to apply our work more broadly, for example, to improve production efficiency and accelerate scientific discovery in materials.
Whoa, that's got nothing to do with autonomy.
But as you pointed out, there's robotics research going on. So maybe they're looking for the ways and means to somehow be able to manufacture using, you know, advanced production technologies.
Well, you know, I ran into, I was at the Autonomous Truck Conference this morning in Detroit, mm-hmm, and we ran into a company called Harvest Technologies, using mobile collaborative robots.
Wow.
So, you know, we've talked a little bit, I think, in the past of this collaborative manufacturing, where, mm-hmm, robots are working right on the assembly line, right amongst people with no safety guards or anything. And if you want to stop the robot, you just hold your hand out. As soon as it touches your hand, boom, it stops. So it's safe to do that. But this company is working with mobile robots. They're not just anchored at a point in, mm-hmm, the assembly line. And they can take over loading and unloading. In fact, they're automating warehouses. And they actually started out on automating farms. And so, there's this very interesting robotic stuff going on. And to your point, you know, with an aging population in Japan, they're, mm-hmm, going to need this kind of robotic stuff. And so we're seeing both Toyota and Honda really getting,
right,
into these.
And you know, we've talked about the Google car a lot on the show. And, you know, one of the initial ideas for that vehicle was they were talking about, you know, senior citizens who were incapable of driving cars, that you would basically have this automated service in perhaps gated communities, that the Google car would come and pick the person up and take the person to the doctor or shopping or wherever it is. So, you know, I mean, I think when we think of autonomy, we're thinking more about the, you know, the guy who's driving down the 405 who is, you know, working and shaving and applying makeup and so on and so forth. But I think a lot of this is, you know, to be a transportation device for people more than an automobile, you know, even though we're looking, you know, like, you know, whether it's the Cadillac, SuperDrive or you know, Tesla's autonomous capability, it comes down to a more simple thing. It's like, okay, a taxi cab without a driver. I mean, and that's what it comes down to. So that's interesting phenomenon.
Well,
there.
Very interesting, though, that Toyota would put all this research money in the U.S. and not do it in Japan.
Well, that's where the money is, no? I mean, you know, the Willie Sutton thing. I mean, because if you're doing, you know, artificial intelligence research, this is the place. I mean, mm-hmm, back when you and I were young, when the MITI, the Japanese...
Ministry of Industry and Trade, or International Trade and Industry.
Yeah, and they had this, what they called the fifth generation program, which was all about artificial intelligence. How'd that work out? Not so well. That's why they're putting $1 billion here.
Yeah, it went about as well as their analog high-def television effort.
But, I mean, so it's very interesting that, you know, we're talking about here's Volkswagen to me in a situation where they really are going to have to pull back. And these guys just are continuing to, you know, put one foot ahead of the other and you know, make this investment.
Look, and we ran a piece in Autoline Daily today or yesterday. Toyota, on a profit margin basis, is the most profitable car company out there, more so than BMW or Daimler.
You know, and I think that a lot of that comes down to the fact, again, that, you know, it's the fundamentals. It goes back to the Toyota production system. It's not like these guys are you know, trying to buy market or, you know, do crazy things.
Well, they did try those crazy things, and the whole thing blew up in their face.
Right.
You know, in the last decade, they went on this binge to become number one. And their quality went to hell in a handbasket.
And they discovered that that isn't going
to... That's not the way to do it.
That's not what we're going to do. You know, it's interesting. So being in Los Angeles yesterday, I'm looking at the Los Angeles Times, of course, and there was a story by this reporter, Dan Weichel. And apparently the first ever study out of the UCLA Luskin Center on Innovation, they looked at HOV lanes and the effects of HOV lanes on the purchase of hybrid and EVs, okay? And so they looked at L.A., Sacramento, San Diego, and San Francisco. And this was from 2010 to 2013, okay? And they wanted to make a determination, what was the effect? And they found that 40% of the sales were directly caused by
HOV.
So that's 24,000 of the 61,000 vehicles sold. So I mean, had they not had that capability, would we have been just like 36,000 and change?
I've said that all along. I saw Anthony Lewandowski speak couple of years ago. He's, of course, with the Google autonomous car program, and they were trying to determine what will people pay for autonomy? What will people pay for mobility? And he had a great presentation where he showed two Toyota Priuses, exact same year, roughly the same mileage, but one had an HOV lane sticker. Because remember, those early hybrids could qualify for them, but then they ran their allotment and they said, okay, no more.
They sold too many.
They sold too many. The difference in the price of these two used Priuses being sold is that the one with the sticker was $5,000 more.
Wow.
And that's what Google read into it. People will easily pay $5,000 for more mobility.
And you know, and part of the study was that they did this because the California legislature is going to begin to look at, you know, in the future, if you want to have cars that are EVs or hybrids, how do you incentivize people to do that through public policy? And the public policy being, in this case, creating HOV lanes or access to those lanes to drive the sales.
And free parking and free charging and a bunch of other things. But yeah, there's no question that, so many people bought their hybrids, especially hybrids,
right,
because they could get in the HOV lane. And look, it was Californians who told me, this is madness. The Prius should be in the stop-and-go traffic where it's the most efficient, and the rest of us should be in the HOV lanes maintaining a steady speed. So, yeah, that's pretty crazy, but yeah, what a stat. I've never heard anybody quantify it, so there we go. 40% of all the sales, isn't that what you
said? That's what he said, yeah. So, and I checked with the reporter today because I wanted to get a clarification on that, and... So it's quite a thing. But, you know, seeing the traffic in L.A., as we're going to see next week.
It's crazy. Hey, we got a question here from S10 Baja saying, would the Autoline crew like to comment on the GMC Jeep Fighter brought up last week? I'm not familiar with...
Well, we were talking about why companies like GMC are letting Jeep have
the market to itself,
the success that it's having, and whether they would be, you know, the appropriate place to go after it. And, you know, and it occurs to me that over the years we've seen, particularly like the Detroit show, when GMC has been coming out with these concept vehicles, that you say to yourselves, you know, that is the one. And had there not been Hummer, I think we would have vehicles like that coming out of a brand like GMC. But I don't know. I mean, why were they not doing it? That was a Hummer.
Actually a Hummer, right.
As we can see by the 7-slot grille. Oh, did I say that?
Yeah. And, you know, we learned with this latest UAW Ford negotiations that Ford is going to bring the Ranger back to the Michigan truck plant, and it's going to bring the Bronco back.
Mm-hmm.
Most people remember the O.J. Simpson Bronco, which had grown into this sort of bloated thing that was like a smaller version of the Navigator or the
right.
Expedition. But if you go back to the original Bronco, that was a cool vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Bill Strope especially, and it took it to the Baja 500 and 1000. Parnelli Jones mm-hmm. was driving it. That's the Bronco I remember. And that was definitely
right.
a Jeep competitor. So that's my question. What do you think? Is Ford going to bring back the O.J. Simpson Bronco?
Oh,
are they going to
no.
bring back the Bill Strope Parnelli Jones Bronco?
Okay, if you think about it, I mean, that what Ford didn't have back then was a Ford Edge, right? They didn't have something that was...
So you're saying if O.J. was running from the police today, he'd be in an Edge.
Well, actually, he wouldn't be in an Edge. I'm thinking maybe he'd be in the Lincoln MKX, which I'm driving right now.
Or MKT.
And, well, that's, I don't know that we need to go there. I think that those guys at Ford are well aware of the fact that they need something that is going to be, you know, a little more
macho,
yeah, and aggro and capable. And I think that they certainly have the engineering capability of doing that. And you know that so if you look at the Ranger, okay, so here's a vehicle that was developed, is being sold in other markets, and if we're truly going to have a one Ford approach, why isn't it here? Because think about it. I mean, the Colorado and Canyon were developed in Thailand for Thailand, right? Now, they were modified here, and Jeff Luke and the guys went at it and made the modifications. But, you know, a lot of that engineering cost was amortized because they were going to do it in that market. Ford's got the same situation. They're looking at what's going on with the sales of the Colorado and Canyon. I mean...
And they have not cannibalized the big trucks.
They haven't cannibalized the big trucks. And, you know, it's also interesting that if you look at the numbers, that when we had Mike Swears from Toyota in the studio and he brought the Tacoma over, which, you know, they have 50% of that market, okay? 50%. And what's happened is that market has grown as a result of Colorado and Canyon.
Right.
So the other question becomes, well, does Dodge bring back Ram bring back the Dakota? I mean, is there going to be this oversized, midsize phenomenon?
Look, you got to believe that they're looking at doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You
got to
believe it, you know, at least talking about it.
Sure.
But no, that's a great point. It grew the segment. It didn't cannibalize the big ones. And that's why I think Ford and Ram were sitting on the sidelines. You know, that was a gutsy move by GM to do it, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually a very smart cafe ploy. Because Ford spent a fortune doing the aluminum version, and maybe the others will have to follow suit. But it's very interesting that GM's cafe strategy was, no, let's bring in a total new product line
mm-hmm.
and not just add cost to the truck that we've got. No, let's expand the market. And but they had to have had their fingers crossed, too, hoping that this was going to happen, i.e., it's not going to steal sales of Silverado and Sierra. And it would grow the whole segment
mm-hmm.
so that they're not stuck with low volume.
Right. You know, and speaking of that aluminum F-150, it just occurs to me that maybe this goes back to when those guys were going through the Henry Ford and they saw a Panhard that was made out of aluminum and said, maybe we should think about this.
Or maybe they saw a Jordan Playboy from the 1920s, which also had aluminum panels. And in fact, I think it was the Jordan that had cast aluminum panels.
Wow.
So that was pretty brave for back then.
Nothing new under the sun is what you're saying.
None whatsoever. You know, we just have some more capabilities, but somebody thought of it a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Da Vinci
thought
of it.
There you go. That's a long time ago.
So good. Hey, Gary, probably a good time to wrap this up. Let's go to L.A. next week and do the show there.
Why don't we do that?
Okay. Hey, everybody, we invite you to join us next week, and thanks for having tuned in tonight.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Chrysler.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.